I want to talk today from a text that I read the last day of our retreat last month at Hokyoji Zen Practice Community down in the Bluff Country of Minnesota. I read it at Hokyoji without comment, the last talk of the last day of retreat. I read this text at the end, and that was it. But today I'm going to try to say something about it. It's a Western text, but I love ancient Buddhist texts, but I also really I'm very happy to find Western readings that say essentially the same thing, however inadvertently. So it's on the cover of your program, and it's from Henri Amiel, who is a 19th century Swiss scholar. And it says, "Let mystery have its place in you. Do not be always turning up your whole soil with the plowshare of self-examination, but leave a little fallow corner in your heart ready for any seeds the winds may bring, and reserve a nook of shadow for the passing bird. Then if a bird sings among your branches, do not be too eager to take it. If you are conscious of something new, thought or feeling, wakening in the depth of your being, do not be in a hurry to let in light upon it. Let the springing germ have the protection of being forgotten. Hedge it round with quiet, and do not break in upon its darkness. Let it take shape and grow." So. So the first two lines are, "Let mystery have its place in you. Do not be always turning up your whole soil with the plowshare of self-examination." So let mystery have its place in you. That's about Zazen, I think, to me. You know, the longer I do this practice, the longer I do Zazen, sitting meditation, the more mysterious it becomes to me. More mysterious and at the same time, simpler. It's a paradox. But at Hokyoji, when we were there for 5 days. There were, what, about 10 or 12 of us, something? 12 of us? Yeah, Kate knows because she cooked for us. How many meals exactly? So we were at Hokyoji, and you could actually see everybody settling down as the days went by. You know, the first day we came in with all this sort of outside energy. There were people who had been there before were sort of happy to get back and be looking at, you know, what had been fixed up, and people who had never been there were looking around to see what the place was like, and we all came in with our expectations and things, and you could see as the days went by this sort of mysterious energy level just kind of settled. You could see it settling. You could see it in all of our activities. You know, you could see it in work, the work that we did. You could see it during the meals. I certainly saw it during Doksan, during the private meetings when people would come in and talk to me. By about the third day, people came in and they were just so much quieter. They were so much quieter. So we bring our whole selves, our entire selves, to this practice. But it's not about self-examination. It's not about turning up the soil with the plowshare of self-examination. You know, Dogen did say, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. But turning up the soil with the plowshare of self-examination seems a lot noisier to me than that. It's a bigger activity. It's much less contemplative. And there's a time and a place for that. But in most of our lives, most of the lives of the people that I know, the thing that we really need is to cultivate a little bit more quiet. We're pretty good at the other side. So that's what we teach here. That's what we teach at Zazen, at MCMC in Zazen. So at this point, I need to stop and say that I'm not suggesting that you should never examine your life. You notice that Emil says, do not always be turning up your soil with the plowshare of self-examination. He doesn't say, do not ever turn up the whole soil. So in our lives, we do lots and lots of turning up the soil. We're good at that. We do plenty of it. In my corporate days, I spent a lot of time in project planning meetings and in training sessions and debugging programs, and I don't remember anybody ever saying, wait a minute, what about the contemplative side of this? You know? Although I have been in priest meetings here where we were doing some kind of serious business stuff, and people have said, hey, wait a minute, what about the contemplative side of this? But my point is that there is a time for that, and there's a time for action, and I'm not saying that that Zen is about passivity in any way, but I'm talking about how this practice, particularly retreat practice, gives us the opportunity to step back from that sometimes, you know. If I thought that everyone needed a talk on how to overthink their lives, a seminar on that, we could talk about that. But I think that's probably not what we need. We need more talk about contemplation and renewal, maybe. So, have you ever been on a farm when they're plowing? Anybody ever been on a farm when they're plowing? It's a pretty amazing thing. And these days, you know, there's these huge, giant tractors. My grandma told me one time that when she was young, they actually plowed with a farm animal, you know, a horse, or I don't know if it was a horse or a mule or what. And it was hard, and it was dusty, you know, it was exhausting work. It was important work. But, you know, there's also a time to put away that plow. It is exhausting, examining ourselves that way. So, give ourselves a break. Hi, come on in. Let's see. So the next lines are, leave a little fallow corner in your heart, ready for any seed the winds may bring, and reserve a nook of shadow for the passing bird. So fallow means it's a section of land that's left uncultivated, left unplanted, so that they'll leave it unplanted for a season or so to restore its fertility. So a fallow corner in your heart, I think, means to have a little area within you that you allow to be quiet and peaceful. You know, and sometimes the wind will blow in a little seed that you'd never expected. And sometimes animals, they like fallow land that's been cultivated, because they can rest there and they can be there undisturbed. A fallow piece of land is it's ready to accept whatever comes along. You know, it's not going to be weeded. It's just going to be left alone. So it's ready to give shelter to unexpected guests. I want to give two examples, both of them having to do with teachers and students. I'm very lucky, very fortunate, to have two Zen teachers. One of them, of course, is our head teacher here, Tim Burkett. And he is a teacher that I definitely cultivated. You know, I marched into his office. I didn't march in. I sidled into his office and asked if he would ordain me. So it was a very it was a situation where I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to do that with him, and I kind of marched in and did that. But the other my other teacher I didn't actually know was my teacher for a long, long time, and that teacher was Tomoe Katagiri, who retired this summer after 40 some years of teaching sewing to Zen students. And when she started, she actually she didn't feel ready or prepared to do that, but she just did it anyway. You know, she started when she first started teaching. She didn't have a book to teach from. And she also didn't really have any experience in doing it. And she hadn't been in this country for a very long time, I think 5 or 6 years or something. And so they had something like 40 students sewing. And what they were sewing was these raksus, Buddha's, their small version of Buddha's robe. And so they had, I think, about 40 students sewing. And it's very complicated. And Tomoe told me recently that the only things that she knew how to say to her students was, it's okay, or please take it out. It's okay, and no, it's not okay. And just with that, she started out and she taught 2 generations of Zen students how to do something they think they didn't know how to do sometimes. She's very unassuming, but she has this very gentle way. It's usually gentle, sometimes it's very fierce, but she has this gentle way of bringing out the best effort in her students, bringing that out in them. So, excuse me. I didn't plan to be her sewing student. I didn't march into her house and say, "I want you to teach me how to be a sewing teacher." I sewed my first raksu in 1997, and the next year she was teaching a sewing class here at MZMC. And I asked if I could come along and help. And that first year, I wasn't much help. I wasn't much help. The next summer, she was teaching at Clouds and Water. And again, I went and I helped. And I was a little bit better, but still not a whole lot of help. But I just kept coming back. I just kept coming back and doing it more and more. And at some point, I would be over at her house once or sometimes twice a week, sewing on one thing or another, and I didn't have any idea that she was my sewing teacher or I was her student. And you know, I'm a little slow. It took me about 7 or 8 years, and then one day, it occurred to me, oh my God, she's my sewing teacher, and I'm her student, and someday she's going to retire. And then I started going down that mind road, and it freaked me out. It's probably a good thing I didn't figure it out until it was that far along. But I didn't have any idea about it, and as it turns out, neither did she. I just found this out last week. I was sitting with her at our 40th anniversary gala, and someone came up and was talking to us. And they asked me about how I became her student, and I told them I kind of bumbled into it. And then they asked her when she knew that I was her student. And, you know, she said that she never knew. She said that she didn't, how did she put this? She she said she didn't want to be greedy. She didn't want to feel greedy about pulling in this person who seemed to be showing up a lot. So she also had sort of no idea, no gaining idea, sometimes we say. But she did train three people as sewing teachers. So there's me, there's Kyoku Whalen at Clouds and Waters Zen Center, and there's Karen Wyken, who lives in Wisconsin. And when she retired this summer, there was a little bit of confusion about terminology. What do we call this? Do we say that that she gave us sewing transmission, like we talk about Dharma transmission? You know, do we say that, you know, we're her disciples? What do we, you know, how do we describe this? And Kyoku asked her about it a couple of weeks ago, and her answer was, no, we don't say any of that. She said, I helped people, and now you're helping people. So that was much better. I liked that. So, excuse me. So when I tell people that I'm a sewing teacher, when people ask me what it is that I teach here, I know that if I tell them, well, I'm a sewing teacher, I'm pretty sure they have absolutely no idea what that means. You know, when Tomoe taught sewing, someone just said this a week or two ago, when Tomoe taught sewing, she was actually teaching the Dharma. She was actually teaching the Dharma. So that's my aspiration, you know. Can we teach Dogen's way? It is Dogen's way. It's been doing it the same, sewing these robes the same way, certainly since 1200, and maybe going back as far as Buddha's time. So we teach Dogen's way. We teach, this is the way I usually think about it, taking Zazen off the cushion and into our lives. We teach people how to make that transition. Teach patience. Teach not knowing. Teach being silent. We teach acceptance. We teach some origami. We teach some origami. I teach people exactly two sewing stitches, and also how to tear out those sewing stitches many, 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 many times, and to do it with some measure of equanimity, ideally. So that's what I think being a sewing teacher is these days, in part. But I never planned to do it. And the other plan that I never had, the other aspiration that I never had, was to have a student-teacher relationship. You know, I was Tim's student but officially for, 7 years or something. And I never aspired to have a pre-student in that way. So naturally, it happened. last year, I met Marcus Barlow at a sewing teachers gathering, and in North Carolina. And when I arrived there, I knew that he was a priest in training, that he was studying with someone. And throughout the time that we were there, I could see that. You know, his priest vow, kind of shone out of him. And it wasn't until the end of the gathering, we were there, I don't know, 5 or 6 days or something, it wasn't until the end that I found out that he was actually no longer studying with his teacher. So this happens all the time. It's not really unusual that people will be in priest training with someone, and then something happens, and then they're not. And that leaves the priest in training in kind of this unusual sort of in-between state, where they've been ordained, but they're not in training, so they're sort of an ordained, not a priest. We talked at the end of the gathering about that a little bit, and he told me a story. And then a couple of times over the winter, he called and we talked on the phone. You know, he asked for some advice, and we talked about it. And then last spring, he invited me down to Atlanta, where he lives, to lead a retreat. And so I went. And after that, we started talking seriously about, a little bit more seriously, about starting up a student-teacher relationship. But we really needed to know each other a lot better. So we started Skyping every week. We started in the one true Dogen way, in the traditional way of becoming a someone's teacher or student. So we started Skyping a couple of times every week. And I was trying to get my head around how to train somebody to be a priest long distance. I know it's being done a lot, but I couldn't kind of get my head around that. And also to get my head around the idea of taking on a student at all. So the next line in Emile's writing is, "Then if a bird sings among your branches, do not be too eager to take it." So I think Marcus was the bird singing in the branches. And I needed to wait and let the decision of whether I wanted to do this sort of reveal itself. I talked to Tim about it, of course, and got his advice and counsel, and he was very encouraging. And I talked to some other teachers who had done long-distance priest training. When Norman Fisher was here last summer, I talked with him about it. I saw Tigan Layton in the summer, and I talked to him about it. They both had long-distance students, and they gave me some very helpful advice. I also did a fair amount of fussing and overthinking it. But that was actually not nearly as helpful as the time that I spent just kind of letting it sit, letting the idea of doing that sit and just be there. So I decided to have him come up here for 10 days, and I invited him to come up for our 5-day retreat at Hokyoji, and then he was here for a few days before that and after that. We talked about having him come up here to Zen Land. We called it Zen Land because there's so many Zen centers here, many more than there are in Atlanta. So I wanted him to come up here and to do a retreat with me, and to meet some people here and spend a whole bunch of time together, some time together. And that went really well. So after the retreat at Hokyoji, we agreed that I was going to be his teacher, and I'm going to go down to Atlanta and lead Rahatsu, which is Buddha's Enlightenment Retreat. It's in early December. I'm going to go down there and lead Rahatsu Sesshin with his sitting group. And we'll do a small ceremony to mark that transition. And he's going to come up here several times a year, and I'll go down there several times a year. And in the traditional way, we'll continue to Skype. So those were two times when I didn't have a plan. And when Tomoe-san didn't have a plan either. So I guess there was some undisturbed corner that was ready to accept the the unexpected but very welcome visitors. It's a lesson that I've learned a lot of times, actually, not to fuss and overthink. And yet, every time I have another opportunity, I must enjoy learning that, because every time I have an opportunity to learn that lesson again, I gleefully set myself up so I have to learn it again. Even though I know that. So, the next lines are, if you are conscious of something new, thought or feeling, wakening in the depth of your being, do not be in a hurry to let light in upon it. These lines reminded me of Joko Beck, who was a Zen teacher in San Diego, California. I talked about her a couple of years ago, right after she died. She pioneered a way of working with her students that included both Zazen and elements of Western psychology. So she would have them, when they sat in Zazen, when thoughts arose, she would have them see the thought as a thought, not go into the storyline, but kind of let the thought go. But if there was an emotion attached to the thought, or if an emotion would arise, especially an afflictive one, she would ask them to just stop for a moment and feel it in their body. Just feel what that emotion felt like in their body. And she told them to not try to suppress it, but just kind of get to know it without analyzing it too much. She had them, she would ask them to sort of forget the thinking about it and just totally be with the felt sense of that emotion. So whether it was fear or anxiety or great joy or happiness, whatever it was, she felt that over time, if they did that, the emotions would learn to sort of transform themselves. They'd transform themselves, and that her students would be able to be less hooked on them, to use a Pema Chodron word. They'd become less hooked by their emotions, you know, less likely to be pulled in and wrapped around the axle by their emotions, less caught by every fleeting thought that went through their brains. And eventually, they would become less reactive in their regular lives, in their lives off the cushion, when these emotions would arise. So we don't teach that way overtly here, but I think, like a lot of Zen centers in this country, we have been influenced by Joko Beck's innovations. So, you know, over time, when we sit, we get used to seeing these thoughts arise, and we get used to seeing these emotions arise, and we get used to noticing their fleeting nature, and we get used to noticing when they first arise, and letting them go. And then maybe over time we become less likely to fuss about them and to overthink them, less likely to turn them into a story. And less likely, particularly we're on the cushion, to take those thoughts and go straight into, well, then I this, and then he that, and then she that, and then what if, and then if only they hadn't done this, you know, and on and on and on and on. So I think Joko had had a really good approach there. The next line, let the springing germ have the protection of being forgotten. So the protection of being forgotten. Well, there's a Zen statement. You know, usually we think of protecting something by paying more attention to it, not by forgetting it. But whatever it is that's springing up in us, whether it's some insight or some thought or some emotion, we notice it. You know, there you are. Hello. Sometimes here you are again. But we don't try to capture it. You know, we don't try to examine it or overthink it. So we give it the protection of being forgotten. Hedge it round with quiet and do not break in upon its darkness. Hedge it round with quiet and do not break in upon its darkness. This is what we're doing when we're in retreat. When we're in retreat, it gets very, very quiet. Collectively, it gets quiet, and individually, within each one of us, it gets very quiet. I think my favorite retreat is Rahatsu because it's very dark and it's very quiet. When it snows, it gets very quiet outside. It's almost the kind of quiet that you get in the country. Somehow everything gets muffled. And everybody stays inside pretty much. And it's also dark. You know, when we get up in the morning, it's dark. The first few sittings, all the sittings before breakfast pretty much, we're sitting with darkness in all the windows. And the same thing in the evening after supper. It's very dark. And it's a peaceful darkness, I think. It's a very quiet darkness. It's the darkness of opportunity to be watchful in a very quiet way, in a very protective kind of way. So hedge it round with quiet and do not break in upon its darkness. And his last line is, let it take shape and grow. So in Zazen, we'd be much more likely to hedge it round with quiet and not nearly as interested in the let it take shape and grow part of this. You know, maybe it will take some kind of shape and maybe it will grow, but really that's sort of almost none of our business. None of our business. In Zazen, we're much more likely to just let it go and not try to wonder what's going to become of this random thought or what's going to become of this idea or this emotion that's arising. So we just kind of let it go and we let it be mysterious for a while. So at the end of the retreat at Hokyoji, I guess that's what I didn't say. I guess that's what I didn't say. Or maybe in this talk. Maybe in this talk that's what I didn't say. Anyway, that's what I have to say about that today. Does anybody else have anything they want to talk about or say? Questions?
Yeah, Jim. I remember sewing my rock suit years ago with Tomoy and thinking it was going to be a real sort of spiritual monolith. It wasn't that at all. In fact, it was one of the most anxiety-ridden periods I've spent. And part of it was that, you know, Tomoy, the Japanese lady, and me, personalities weren't quite matched. Mm-hmm. And my problem was, when I look back at why the anxiety was there, was because I was constantly trying to do it the easy way, the shortcut way. I couldn't stop myself. And she was there and showing me how to do it, and other teachers. And there was a point where I had sewed for 10 hours and I had to remove all the stitches. And the teachers were standing around my rocket seat, and she was there. And he said, "Well, Tony, what should you do? What should you do?" And she looks up, she says, "Give up," you know, which meant, okay, buddy, get in line and start doing it the right way. And for that brief period of time, I think I actually said, okay, I'm going to do it their way. And since then, you know, to recreate that in my life. But that was my learning lesson, sewing my rakusu. And finally, at the end, when we presented our rakusu to her, she was like, okay, you get to. That was my life lesson, because I couldn't do it by the book, and then that when we had a book.
I live my life
not trying to find shortcuts all the time. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things about sewing. Doing this kind of sewing is you learn so much about who you are and how you operate. It's a very interesting thing to do, and it's a very, very interesting thing to watch other people do. So, thanks. Anything else? Yeah.
I forgot her name.
The
idea of combining psychology.
Oh, Joko Beck.
Joko Beck, yeah. Her idea of letting your emotions is kind of be like the cloud that, you know, that you're experiencing right now, floating past, and you feel them, but then they're gone without getting sucked into thinking about why. That's very much what I've been been doing, is drawing me into meditation over the last couple of months. I really like that.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. It's something that we hardly give any thought to now, but when she first started teaching that, it was controversial, and people weren't really sure if that was okay or not to teach that way. But it's.
I kind of got the idea from here, where a writer that reads about, you know, let your thoughts be like clouds.
Mm-hmm.
I do that throughout the day. Start feeling sucked into depression or whatever.
Yeah, it's not it's not the thoughts that are the problem. It's the storyline and the chatter that follows them, and the things that we tell ourselves that we are so sure of that turn out quite often to not be the case at all. Anybody else? Yeah.
I just really love this.
Isn't it a wonderful quote?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It is beautiful. I started this practice probably a year and a half ago, and I'm always wanting to self-examine, dig in. And this gives me some peace. I don't have to supposedly sit with it. That's very hard. That's very simple. So thank you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love the poetry of it. The way he describes it, and you know, using the all the nature language, the bird resting on the branch, you know, it's wonderful.
Yeah, because for some time, am I doing this right? You know, am I doing this right? Am I sitting my cushion right?
Yeah.
So there's that expectation. There's expectations, and you want to follow. You had mentioned rules. You know, guidelines, and I'm kind of opposite. I don't like to take the shortcut. I like to take the long, hard route. And that's not necessarily the right route. You know, the shortcut route might not be the best route, but this long route is, it's dark and it's murky and it's uncomfortable. This other path, this one's a little bit more quiet. And I really appreciate that. You know, I don't have to have this plow out operating all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can just let it be.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, yeah, Nathan.
So you mentioned when I started, she was take it out or it's okay.
Yeah.
Where do you think she ended up? I noticed when I asked her, you know, if I should take, you know, what I should do about something, and she said maybe take it out, but she just left it open.
Yeah. She's very fond of saying, "What's your rock, Sue?" You know, she'll tell you if it absolutely needs to come out.
Yeah. She'll sometimes need to take.
Yes, sometimes she takes it away and just starts tearing those stitches out. I think so often with these things we come back to where we started. You know, to it's okay, or take it out, or towards the end, she almost, towards the end, this makes her, she lives right over. She's just retired. But she can almost teach with a look now, you know, or a suggestion. And part of that is just having that sort of authority. But yeah. Yeah.
I learned one thing from my mom too, that she really cared about the rapid growth. And I didn't like my parents enough about it. And so I started to avoid her. I would come to the building when I knew she wasn't going to be here. Or I would, my blood pressure would rise when she started to come toward mm-hmm. me, because I knew that she really cared.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to have somebody caring about me that much. She got to the point where she started to go through my pincushion, and she started to pull out all of my bent needles and tell me that I can't have those anymore. And took my bent needles away from me. And I was away. She was just saying to me, "You deserve better. You deserve to not be so innocent."
Yep.
And she, I think she did.
Maybe not always in the very moment.
No.
But yeah, Tomoy knew what a good sower. We talked about this. Tomoy knew that you were a good sower, and she held you to a very strict standard, which was an interesting. It was an interesting thing to watch. So yeah, Stephanie.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to think about Tomoy. One memory that I can remember feeling, if that's possible, I remember that she gave us an opportunity to feel what it might be like in Japan, where people can get into other people's business all the time in a very unintrusive way, because it sort of emanated a feeling in me that this is not much what it might be like in Japan, where people have not the sense of being an item and everyone needs a permission to enter, but we are so connected that you can enter, but you always have to do that respectfully, and that's what she did. So she entered my mind with the standard that you mentioned, and you know, the only trace that she left was really my voice saying, "Yeah, you kind of are like her." But she made that happen, but I was saying it. But she was able, with her Japanese way, to be, you know, cross all these boundaries that in Minnesota we always apologize if we just ever get to smile closer to someone else.
And you know, they don't do the sewing practice in Japan so much. It was sort of lost there, and it's been revived more or less in this country. Dokai Jorgensen, the head teacher at Hokyoji, went to Japan to do some ceremonies following, do some ceremonies a few years ago. And he took along the robe that he had sewn himself. And he went to one of the monasteries in Japan, and the abbot of the monastery pulled all of his monks in to show them this robe. "Look, you know, this guy sewed his own robe. Can you believe it?" And they had never seen or imagined such a thing. So, it's been revived in this country. It's pretty wonderful.